This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is photographer Annie Leibovitz. Born in Waterbury, Connecticut in 1949, her books include Annie Leibovitz Photographs, Photographs Annie Leibovitz 1970 to 1990, Olympic Portraits, Women, American Music, A Photographer's Life, and currently Annie Leibovitz at Work, just published by Random House. Welcome to Between the Covers, Annie.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you.
You bought your first camera when your father was stationed at Clark Air Force Base, is that right?
It was between my first and second year of school. I'd finished a year of painting, being a painting major, and my father was stationed at Clark Air Force Base outside of Vietnam. It was the main R&R base outside of Vietnam, and it had a big hospital there. They brought in a lot of wounded soldiers from Vietnam. My father himself went into Vietnam, once a month. I did not want to go to the Philippines. I really wanted to stay in the States. And my father came back and just literally, dragged me over to the Philippines. And so I was sort of at a loss a little bit. And my mom took a trip to Japan to do a workshop there, and I went along with her. And when I was in Japan, you buy a watch, you buy a camera, and I bought a camera, and I climbed Mount Fuji. I talk about that story, climbing Mount Fuji with a camera, and finding, getting heavier and heavier, and what an interesting lesson that was. And then went back to Clark Air Base, and they had a base darkroom, and I just started taking pictures around the base and going into the darkroom and using it. And then I went back to school and took a night class in photography. And then by the following summer, I decided, I decided that photography is really what I wanted to do. I mean, I was young, painting. I wasn't ready to isolate myself into a painting studio, and the work at the time coming out of the Art Institute was kind of like angry abstract expressionism, and I think when you're young you're looking for reality. You want things to be real, and I wasn't ready to isolate myself in some way, and the photography department was hopping. It was fun. It was like it was very social, and the camera. The camera got me out. It was like having a friend, and you could walk around with it, and it took you to places that you never dreamed you would never go by yourself. It sort of empowered you, made you feel comfortable, being out on your own.
One thing I don't think people understand is how hard physically photography is.
Yeah.
It's really hard work.
Yeah, it's funny, I don't carry when I'm not taking pictures, I find myself when I'm in New York, I don't carry a bag, because I just, having carried bags all these years, I have pockets and I like to put things in my pocket, but I can't stand carrying a bag, because it is physically pretty demanding. I'm lucky now, because I do have people who help me, assistants, and they do move the equipment around. But for the first 10, 12 years, I carried, a case of lights, a small case of lights, and the cameras, myself. So some days I could pick it up, some days I couldn't. It's like some days it just felt heavier, depending on some day. Well, I could usually pick it up at the beginning of the day. At the end of the day, I couldn't pick it up.
Did the Vietnam War change your sense of who you thought you would become?
Well, it was awkward. I mean, I was going to school in San Francisco, and my father was, in the military, stationed at Clark Air Force Base. I was embarrassed, I was definitely confused. And I ended up leaving the Art Institute and going off to Israel for a few months. I actually didn't know if I was going to come back. I actually joined an olpon, which is where you work half a day and you learn Hebrew. And I sort of worked out my own independent study class at the school, at the Art Institute, and told them that I was going to photograph the kibbutz as if it was the family. That was the class that the class that I would have been missing. I basically set up my own independent study program with every teacher and went off. And then when I went to Israel, of course, and spent time there, I realized I was very lucky. It was sort of like a boot camp for me, you know. And I think it was a good physical labor is a really good remedy for you know, thinking through your life as a young person. And I was, and it gave me a lot of discipline and working on the kibbutz. And I realized towards the end of my stay there that you know, I had a country and I had a place, and I was lucky because most of the people in Israel, you know, were in Israel because they didn't have a country. And so I felt pretty renewed going back to school. And it was only shortly after that I started working for Rolling Stone.
What did you learn by working at Rolling Stone? What were the best things that came to you then?
Well, what did I not learn? I mean, basically, yeah. I grew up, you know, and I mean, can you imagine having that kind of training program, you know, working 13 years for Rolling Stone? It was a young magazine. It was, you know, no one really told me what to do. No one really knew, not because they didn't want to. It's just they didn't know any. No one knew, you know, really kind of what we were doing. And I learned as I did it, you know. And what a great proving ground. I mean, it was coming from a school of reportage, personal reportage work. You know, Robert Frank, Cartier-Bresson, that kind of school from the Art Institute. To suddenly magazine work, and then more importantly, the setup picture, the more formal picture, because I was suddenly meeting people, you know, on assignment, and it was as if it was an appointment, and you know, inevitably the subject would say, well, what do you want me to do? You know, what, you know, what should I do? And it was awkward. You know, it was like, well, you know, why don't you do this? Yeah. I mean, so it became even more comfortable. I think it was the beginning of trying to understand portrait work. I mean, originally working at Rolling Stone, I thought I should be more of a journalist, and I was looking at life and you know, Bert Stern, of course, and Eugene Smith, and but it didn't really suit what I was doing. I mean, I really, you know, meeting people on assignment, and not really having the kind of time, I really had to sort of think of how to, portrait work became more of a style that felt appropriate for the kind of, appointments I had with people. And I, in the book, it actually there's a section on the conceptual work, which begins in the, you know, really starts beginning at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and pinpoints two photographs, you know, Robert Penn Warren and Tess Gallagher, which were shot for Life magazine, actually, because, you know, Life asked me to do a few things, and it's very blatant there, you know, what is happening to the work. By reading, you know, Tess Gallagher's poems and reading Robert Penn Warren's poems, I began to try to incorporate the poems, the, you know, their work in the portrait, so that, you know, I was almost illustrating the poems by using the poet. And that was what I was starting to do, is starting to sort of gather information, doing research on each subject, trying to find something about them that could be incorporated into a visual statement. And and so there's a section in the book about how that began. But, you know, that's the yin and the yang of the work is really, you know, the setup picture. What's better, the setup picture or the found picture? And you know, it will always be the tension in the work. I mean, you know, you know, I still, again, since the book is really directed to a young photographer, at the end of it all, I say, you know, in a section called Being There, you know, I say, look, you know, if you see something and it's right in front of you and you found it, you know, take that picture. You don't need, it's how you see. It's not really the equipment or whether it's black and white or it's color. It's really the content. So, and it's my struggle all the time. You know, I mean, do I touch this situation or do I photograph it as I see it? And they're both valid, interesting ways to work. And
you say there's also sometimes a tension when you're shooting with a Polaroid back and you get the moment, but when you shoot with the regular camera, it's gone.
Well, this is an interesting time right now because, you know, digitally you get to have the Polaroid and then you get to keep it, and then you because you're seeing what you need to see on the back, and then you move on and take pictures. I mean, it's actually pretty exciting. You get to keep it all. I mean, I'm really enjoying the digital work now.
Do you find that a digital camera brings more light to the medium than the eye sees?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you always could, even with film, if you, you know, put a camera on a tripod, you could, or if you, gave it a longer exposure than necessary, you could definitely, you know, be seeing more. But that's exactly the main advantage, I think, or the excitement for me about digital is that the ASA, the speed of the film, you know, which you can change on the camera as you're working, there you are suddenly at 3200, and you're in rooms that you never could photograph in before, and I don't need light anymore. I need less light. I mean, I could either do it more. I could use the ambient completely, or if I want to, I can add a little bit of strobe just for some direction. But that I'm using less light now, and it's very, very exciting. I mean, to me, it's so exciting. I mean, to go into the corners of the rooms and photograph where light has, you know, has ebbed off. I'm photographing in places that I never could photograph before. So are you seeing more than your eye sees? I guess you could say. You could say that in some places, but I think it's more, you know, what you're seeing. I think you're actually getting closer to how you're actually seeing. It's pretty exciting.
I love the John Cleese photograph done pre-digitally, how easy it would be to have done that with a digital camera. Tell us what you had to do in order to shoot him hanging upside down from a tree limb.
It was quite a production, actually. There is a kind of a loss going on now with the digital work where there used to be a kind of an idea that to try to do the picture, you know, without any kind of gimmickry, you know, I mean that if you, how to pull it off without, any, how do you
manipulation?
Say manipulation? Thank you. I knew this was a word, you know, and how to those early pictures where when you were sort of doing these strange feats, you know, like John Cleese upside down from the tree. I mean, he literally is hanging from a cable wire, and in order to clear the picture, I had a 60-foot crane, you know, hoisting him up, and he's hanging, and the pressure of the harness against his chest. I mean, he almost blacked out a couple times, and he went up twice actually, and which is why his face is so red. And I actually, if you look at the picture, I think I admire him so much for doing it that I kept the wire in the picture. It's actually there, you know, to show him hanging.
Depicting motion has always been troublesome for photographers. You write about photographing the hurdler Edwin Moses, and there you learned about the anticipatory nature of sports photographers. Can you explain that a bit for us?
That's a funny story, actually, because I almost feel like I'm sort of after the decisive moment. I'm such a studied moment, you know, because I admire sports photographers because they know how to preconceive, or they know where something's going to happen, and they seem to be able to follow action. I've never done that. I'm sort of everything has to stay pretty still for me. But that being said, it's so interesting now digitally, because, you know, the speed aspect is since you have higher speeds now, you know, you can shoot more in action, and I'm that too is a big breakthrough for me. I mean, it's really exciting. But in this particular case, it was some of the first work I did with athletes, and I was working with this hurdler, and I had the camera at the hurdle, and I asked him to run down the track and jump the hurdle, and I started off with Polaroids to see make sure that I was going to get it, and he came down the track and he jumped, and I pulled the Polaroid and he's not there. And I said, okay, do it again. And, you know, he ran down the track and jumped again. And then I had a piece of a foot. So I realized, oh my goodness, in order for me to take this picture, I can't see it. You know, I'm going to have to shoot, you know, and not see it. You know, and because if I actually shoot when I see it, I've missed it. It's like, you know, it was my first lesson with, you know, the split second, you know, and timing, you know, and it was a really big lesson. It's so interesting now because I was on the road with Obama, and I watched the AP and the UPI photographers, the wire photographers, and when I saw Obama, you know, get out of his car and run, you know, run into the building, I saw the AP guy take his motor drive and just, you know, hold it down, and rattle, you know, rattle off a whole string of pictures. And in my day on the road, that the motor drive was considered a no-no. You were supposed to be able to, like, that was cheating, you know. And not only that, it was well known that if you used the motor drive, you could very well miss the picture, because, you know, you would be shooting with it and you wouldn't really, you know, get the picture, because it only did so many frames, you know, a second. And so, you know, when I first saw this AP photographer do it, I kind of looked at him and like, oh, well, that's kind of, you know, ooh, you know. And then I watched him later and I saw him, you know, at his makeshift computer desk, you know, editing. And what I began to realize is the new digital cameras, and they, you know, again, they're getting better every second. You know, they're doing like 9 frames a second. You know, so you're actually shooting a small film, and you are getting these moments that you couldn't get before. And of course, I immediately went out and bought, you know, the new camera that could do that many frames in a second. And of course, it backs up. You can only do it for like 2 or 3 seconds, but it is kind of exciting to see. You know, have the possibility to get those in between, you know, seconds now. And I'm still not 100% convinced that you might still miss the picture. Because there is something about a heightened moment, in a pose, let's say a dance pose or something, that still needs a kind of a sense of timing. It can't be done recklessly, I think. But
you write that you came to photography through dance, and there's another place where motion is involved. I mean, it's hard to depict the dance.
Well, actually, that's now that we have these new cameras, I'm kind of interested in going back and trying to do some dance work now, to see what I can do. And I, you know, having done that work, and there's a chapter in the book about working with Baryshnikov and Mark Morris down in Florida, you know, I did come to the conclusion that, you know, dance was one of those arts that, you know, was going to remain, you know, that kind of protected itself. You couldn't really photograph dance, you know, it's going to be, but you could photograph a heightened moment, or you could photograph a portrait of a dancer, which...
Strength and repose.
Exactly. So, but I actually now, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm kind of interested in what can be done now. I'd really like to go back and do a little more work in that area and see what could happen with this new ability. I mean, there's I just worked with a camera called the Red camera. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it actually... it has it's shooting 24 frames a second, but it's the frame is, I mean, the frame itself is actually is as good a quality as a still on a good digital camera. So I just worked with it, and I found it a little frustrating because I had so many frames. It was, you know, hard to really, really edit. But I was photographing Tina Fey dancing, and it was interesting to see her really dance and rock out. But to not worry about whether I got that heightened frame moment. But I'm still playing with things. I mean, that's the whole thing. Is you are always a perpetual student. I mean, it's, you know, it's especially with the new, you know, I try to downplay the equipment. It's important to downplay the equipment. It's not about equipment, but on the other hand, if you've been doing it for over, 39, 40 years, it's when something new comes out, you can't turn your back on it. It's just too exciting.
Your great friend Susan Sontag wrote a lot about photography. What did she teach you that you didn't know before?
She didn't really teach me as much as she was sort of a monitor, of the work in some way. I mean, she loved popular, popular culture, and I think she was amused, by me more than anything. But I think that more importantly, she came at a time when in my work where I think I needed a sense of direction in what I was doing. She really just set an example, for me. She didn't really, and she felt that I was good, but that, I could be better. And that was something to constantly have to work towards. When she went to Sarajevo, it inspired me to just take off from the Vanity Fair work and go by myself with a camera and follow suit, just to see. She was constantly again raising the bar, for me in a certain sense, and demanding the best, of yourself, because she did that with herself. And so she pretty much just set an example.
It strikes me that in Sarajevo you got more into the moment and away from the process. It was so immediate for you there. Did it change you?
Well, when you go to a war, life is pretty spared down. I mean, it's all about life and death. I mean, it really is it's a great, I sort of feel like everyone should be shot at once, so they understand, what that means. I mean, but we have such a horrific war going on now that it's even hard to compare them. But what's going on in Iraq is the nature of terrorism today. But yes, I mean, was it changing? I mean, was it life changing? Sure. I mean, to see death, and what we do to each other. Definitely, yeah. I mean, it was hard to come back from Sarajevo and worry about which side of Barbra Streisand is the best side to shoot from. I mean, I think it was a great leveler and equalizer. I mean, I think it's important to sort of stay centered and on the ground in this work.
You learned a lot from Hunter Thompson, it seems, because he made you go out on your own.
Right. He pushed me away, which was a good thing. I mean, in retrospect, I mean, it felt, it didn't feel good at the time. And when you look back at it, now you realize that he sort of forced me to look for myself. And, I was very lucky to work with him and Tom Wolfe. But the reality is, in the long run, I mean, first working at Rolling Stone in those early days, I was working with a lot of writers that came from newspapers, and they were used to, the photographer was, you were like, you came second, whenever you went out on a story, they would do their interview or their story, and then they would say, okay, go ahead, take a picture now, and you have like, 10 minutes to take the picture. And I began to find the story actually in the book, or the chapter in the book is really about working with writers, and I began to find that I wanted my own time, and how now I actually don't work with writers. I go out and value my own time with the subject.
I have a short list of authors I've never interviewed and would love to. Do you have a short list of people you'd like to photograph but haven't been able to do so far?
Not who are still alive. I pretty much am photographing everyone I think I would want to, especially to keep the body of work relevant and of our time, but because I do feel responsible to that. But I think sometimes I feel bad that I missed Martha Graham. She was still alive when I started working, and I didn't quite take in when I first started and I was so young that people went away. And I wish I'd been a little bit more conscientious about that at the beginning, but I just didn't, you just don't know. You don't really take in that people go away at the beginning. And you know, Elvis Presley would have been great. I would have liked to. Marilyn Monroe, they were all interesting people.
For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach, my guest today, photographer Annie Leibovitz. Her most recent work, Annie Leibovitz at Work, has just been published by Random House. I'm really glad you dropped by this morning, Annie. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for the coffee, Jim. It really is good. It's great. Thank you. It really helped. Thank you.